Time for our profile interview. And what we do is we speak to someone to find out more about them, to find out exactly who they are, find out about their organization, where they come from. And perhaps you'd also like to pose a question as well. Well, here's somebody who we speak about quite often in Eyewitness News. And in fact, every single time this country's in trouble or someone's been kidnapped or there's been some sort of disaster or we need help, the gift of the givers, they are there. So we thought this morning what we would do on 702 is speak to Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman, who joins us now. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning, Ray.
It's good to chat to you. And I've thrown a lot of sunshine your way, but I think you really deserve it because the gift of the givers, you seem to have that Superman cape that you put on, and when South Africa's in trouble, you guys are there.
But it's, to be fair to the community, to everybody else, it's 39 years of experience. And of course, all credit goes to the teams. The teams who work are committed South Africans, patriotic, who care for the people, who don't care whether it's Christmas, Eid, or Diwali, or whatever it may be. They're all committed to help fellow being, and that's what makes a difference. The teams are compassionate, they have the heart, that's the full-time workers, but even the volunteers, the medical teams, the paramedics, the counselors, when the search and rescue teams, well, when called upon, in fact, they call you before you can call them. Everybody's absolutely keen to get involved and help wherever necessary.
Doctor, just describe your organization. Tell us how big is it, when did you start it, and what is it comprised of?
It's part of the person, myself, you know, and it's in 1992. I was in Turkey on the 6th of August, 1992. It was a Thursday night. It was a Muslim holy place, a place of prayer, a Sufi place, where what the West knows as Sufism. And it was 10 o'clock at what is called a zikr. A zikr is a celebration of God's names. You chant the names, and then after that program is over, and people of all religions were attending. And at 10 p.m., the spiritual teacher looks me, sitting in the corner of the room, looks me in the eye, I'm sitting in the other corner of the room. And he says in fluent Turkish, and I don't speak a word of Turkish. And he says to me, my son, I don't speak and I don't understand. Mm. He says to me, my son, in fluent Turkish, I'm not asking you, I'm instructing you to form an organization. The name in Arabic will be Waqful Waqifin. Translated, it means gift of the givers. You will serve all people of all races, all religions, all colors, all cultures, all classes, of any geographical location and of any political affiliation. But you will serve them unconditionally. You will not expect anything in return, not even a thank you. This is an instruction for you for the rest of your life. Serve people with love, kindness, compassion, and mercy. And remember, the dignity of man is foremost. And then he said, remember, my son, that whatever you do is done through you and not by you. This was a spiritual message. I told you, I don't understand Turkish.
Yeah.
But I understood every single word that he said in Turkish. And I asked him, how is it that when other people here speak Turkish, I don't understand, but when you speak Turkish, I understand? He said, when the hearts connect and the souls connect, the words become understandable. Come to your question, what do we do? I asked him, you give me this instruction, what am I supposed to do? What aspect of helping people am I supposed to do? He told me one line, you will know. And immediately I walked out of there, we got involved in a civil war in Bosnia. And that basically set the map of what we were going to do. It was going to be a disaster intervention organization, a disaster intervention and management. And whatever we do around that will be secondary. And we've got 21 different categories of projects. But disaster intervention is our biggest.
Sure. Wow. That's a huge story. I want to talk about Bosnia because I remember I worked as a journalist in those days. And I remember Waqful Waqifin. I remember your organization. Why did you change the name? Was it just to make it more familiar with South Africans?
Yes. You know, it's a complicated name for even South African Muslim people because that was an Arabic name. You know, in the beginning, it came up like that. And then the translation, Gift of the Givers, it was easier for people to understand and relate to. You know, and also sometimes with a religious block, and you know, you have tunnel vision, and you know, you hear Arabic name, and all terrible kind of people, it puts a block. And he said, you know, to make it more open to people, not to think anybody's excluded, let's use the English version. The only guy that used to use Arabic version is from your radio station, John Robbie.
Yeah.
You know? You always say Waqful Waqifin. Every time I talk to him, he never said the English one. And, you know, and slowly over time, people start relating to the organization name, and it just grew and grew and grew. And, of course, since we speak, we don't speak Arabic much of us. You know, it's also easier for all of us in English format. And it showed that it's open to all. It's not restricted to one community or one group. It has worldwide appeal. And the name itself in English is just so, people just respond to it so beautifully.
I want to go back to Bosnia again. That was a brutal war. Just explain what you did, some of the experiences of your organization.
Well, immediately I walked out of the place in Turkey, Istanbul. We responded with 32 containers of aid. This was all food, medical supplies, and a whole range of other items, bottled water, and we took it across. It was my first project. My first project was not even a local project. It was an international project. It was a war zone. We had to learn about exchange control, customs, rules of different countries, war zones, conflict, conflicting parties, being a foreign country, changing borders, all that kind of stuff, moving goods, shipping, planes, all that kind of stuff. 85% to 90% of what I know now, I learned in that first mission. I went back in November and took in 8 containers of aid. This was winter clothing, warm stuff, warm blankets, warm jackets, because the chill factor in Eastern Europe in November, December is minus 21 degrees. Now, minus 21 degrees for Europe is not an issue when you have indoor heating, but here there was no heating, no gas, no roof, no window, no door, no food, no medical supplies, no warm clothes, nothing. Under that circumstances, it was absolutely disastrous. So we took that in. At that point, to the second trip, the idea came that because hospital services were destroyed, why don't we build a containerized mobile hospital? I had seen 3 units built by the Defense Force for Arms Corps in a show in Nazareth, a theater, sterilization unit, and X-ray. And the thought came to me, well, as the teacher said, you know, everything is done through you and not by you. And by inspiration it came. I had no idea about a containerized hospital. But whilst I was there, I said, why don't we build a containerized hospital for you guys? And they said, what's that? I said, I don't know. The word just came to my mouth. I don't know.
That's good.
Home and got all of the company, after the guys that built those trailers, after the retailing, got all of them. We sat together and we designed a 28-container hospital. Each one self-sufficient, each one not dependent on the other one. If one gets warm, the hospital can still function.
Yeah.
State-of-the-art equipment. And we took it from South Africa to Bosnia. And it was important in many, many ways. Because Africa is always regarded as a begging nation, poor nation, can't do anything, only has conflict, only has poverty, only has disease, always backward, always putting the arm out, hands out, always asking for things. And we wanted to change that mindset. So to us, it was a huge achievement. It was funded purely by South Africans. It was purely South African technology. It was a world first. It was designed in South Africa, and it was taken from Africa to Europe. So it achieved multiple benefits. And when CNN filmed it on the 1st of February, 1994, they said, the containerized South African mobile hospital is equal to any of the best hospitals in Europe. Now, there's no container hospitals in Europe. A container hospital from South Africa was compared to fixed building hospitals in Europe. That is the quality of what we did in 1993.
Sure, that's quite something. I'm thinking about Bosnia, but I'm thinking about Syria. Have you been involved in giving relief in Syria? Because that's a very nasty conflict and a dangerous place to be.
Yes, I was there. I started my first trip to Syria. It was in October 2012. And it was a lookout. It was a place just to look out, you know, look and see what we can do. I went place to place. I couldn't find a medical guide. I couldn't find one person who could give me any idea on medicine, because in a war zone, the most important thing is medicine and medical support. And disappointed, I was about to leave. And it's important to follow the story because it puts a lot of things into perspective. I was about to leave, and as I was about to leave disappointed, suddenly a guy comes down from the mountain and he speaks English. I said, you speak English? He says, yes. I said, who are you? I'm Dr. Ahmed Gandur. What do you do? I'm a cardiac thoracic surgeon. I said, what? You're a medical guy. He says, yes. I said, I need, can we do some medical support in this place called Darkush? He says, yes. Come here. We can go right now. Takes me to a building that was supposed to be used for an old age home. In our region, we don't have like old age homes. People are supposed to look after their own families themselves. In circumstances, yes, you have to be, because there's nobody else to look after the family in person. So it didn't work. Nobody took the building. Nobody came there. So I said, Ahmed, this building is good. It'll be good for a start, but it's too small. You know, when these particles get involved, can the thing go upwards, backwards, sideways, and forwards? And across the road, I see that empty land there. Can you get that land? They said, that land you can't get. It belongs to bad people. Then I said, okay, the building itself, can we do something about it? They said, look, I don't know. Now, because I was a foreigner in the building, people were very curious and walked in because they saw my gift to give a shirt and a South African flag. And people said, what are you doing here? And I said, we're trying to put a medical facility here. And, you know, we need to see if we can find something. Can we extend this building? So the guy looks at me and he says, yes, we can extend the building. I said, how do you know? He said, we can go 2 floors up. I said, what kind of person are you? How can you tell me a thing like that? How can you just tell me, is there concrete in the ground? Is there steel structure here? You know, how do you tell me a thing like that? He said, my friend, take it easy. I'm the guy that built this building. Wow. 25 million people in Syria. 15 million people displaced. What's the chance that the guy that built the building is there the same day that I'm there?
Yeah, it's quite incredible. It really is. Question, though.
On that same extension, in 70 days, we converted that into a fully-fledged emergency facility. In 70 days, we took in a whole South African medical team on the 12th of April 2013. That building now is gone backwards, upwards, 2 floors, forwards. I got the land on the other side and put in 5 buildings. We got blood banks, dialysis, CT scans, you know, primary health care. We've got full oxygen facility, bulk oxygen facility for COVID. That thing has grown into a massive facility, seeing between 15 and 20,000 patients a month.
Wow. Now, hearing you say that, question. You are Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman. You were born in Potchefstroom in the Northwest. You started your schooling in Potch, but moved to Sash Street College in Durban in 78. You then qualified as a medical doctor at the then University of Natal Medical School in 84. Do you ever get involved in wanting to use your medical skills? Because you can join in.
Well, there's two problems with that. One is I stopped practice in 1994, so I'm not registered anymore. Which there's clamor for me to re-register, which I'm doing right now. Secondly, even if I wanted to practice, I couldn't, even if I had my registration, because my time is so involved in logistics, in security, especially in a war zone, in making sure everything comes in. It would be impractical for me to be working on seeing a patient if, you know, there's so many other things to do around me. So what I do, I manage medical people, and I manage teams, and I manage infrastructure and logistics, except two times. In 2004, when we responded to the tsunami in a place called Harfoon in the northeast of Somalia, and in a place called Bosassa, not far from Bosassa. And in 2005, August, then there was a huge famine in Niger, and lots of kids were dying from hunger. Those are the two areas I got involved, I started practicing medicine, just to assist the medical teams, because we were not that many. That's only two times that I think I got involved in actually seeing patients. The other missions didn't allow me. There was just no time. You know, without getting involved in medicine, you were having 20-hour days just sorting out a whole range of things because you've got so many disciplines, so many departments, so many needs, so many things to check. And you bring in second team and a third team. There was just no way you could practice.
Yeah. How do you attract medical staff? I mean, do you approach people and say, we're building a team, please come with us? How does it work?
Well, we basically have to tell people we can't take you because you've got too many.
Wow. good problem to have.
And it's even worse now. You know, when we go on missions, you'll be surprised. We are South African team. We're from Africa, the useless continent, as the world sees it. You know, the people all go backwards and all you know, can't do anything properly. But when we go, we get calls from Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, Germany, other parts of Europe, Botswana, Mozambique, Zambia, UAE. People calling, can we join your teams? Can we join your teams? We want to come with you. I said, my friends, I've got 250 South Africans on standby to come with me. And the South Africans know exactly how to work with each other. They worked in the same hospital, same other system works. How am I going to fit you guys in? I'm sorry, I would have loved to take you, but I can't even take everybody from my own country.
Yeah, it's a lovely problem to have. Now, finance. And I'm sure a lot of people are wondering, how do you finance the operation? Is it corporates? Is it just donations? How does it work? Because you guys literally spend billions of rands. I know you were involved with the Helen Joseph Hospital, or there around doing the borehole. How do you pay for all of this?
The spiritual teacher, I met him several times. I've been to Turkey 27 times. And every time I met him, he gave me some other message. And he told me, you will never look for money. He said, people will come to you. Money is something you will never have a problem with. In 29 years, we've never had to make a proposal, put paid advertising, phone people, go door to door, make an announcement in advertising for money, paid advertising for money. We don't even have fundraisers. As part of the organization, the policy is not to have fundraisers. That's our policy. And people come to us. It started off not corporates. It started off with very, very ordinary people. It initially started with Muslims only. Being a Muslim organization, Muslim support came initially because other people didn't know what we were doing. And the support came initially, and then other groups started getting involved, and other groups started getting involved. And when we removed Walk for Walk in and made it gift for the givers, people started getting, understanding it and opening their mind more towards it. And then over a period of time, the real turnaround of corporates came in 2017. And you know what happened? It's because our teams are very mixed, black, white, Christian, Hindu, Muslim. So when the groups travel with us, they bring the message home, and their families and the people that work for them then realize that this is not a religious thing. It's a humanitarian thing that's open to everyone.
Yeah.
So that helps. And then, and of course, when you get involved in the country, and 99% of our involvement is in all poor communities in this country. And people see that, and the communities themselves then speak to people who work in companies and their family and friends. But the turnaround came in 2017, when we got involved in the NYSDA fire. It was the first time the corporates really understood our capability. A few months later, we did the Balls Beaufort West. 2018, the whole year, we were day zero in Cape Town. 2019, Makanda and the drought in the Eastern Cape. 2020, COVID. And 2021, where we are now, the crisis. So sure. when the corporate saw that, the support for corporate started growing, as well as from professional people and ordinary people and old age homes and school children and everybody else. And then with COVID, the companies in South Africa were basically subsidiaries of the big companies in America and Europe saw what we were doing. And we started getting international interest from these companies, parent companies of these companies in South Africa, and they started calling us. And that clamor is now increasing more and more during the COVID itself in the third wave, and now with what's happening in KZN.
Yeah. Do you have a relationship with government? You were given the Order of the Baobab in silver, which is quite an honor. Did thereafter or before that, have you established a relationship with governments, or are you just totally independent and you'll phone them up and say, we've got this?
My policy has been, the spiritual teacher told me, you will never be in government, you will always work with government. And that's from the first day, it's been like that. We have a phenomenal relationship with every department in government, you know, except that they do things slowly. And I always tell them, you know, I've got a very good relationship. I tell them, you guys don't understand three words: urgency, emergency, and disaster.
Yeah.
Those three things are not in your vocabulary. You guys don't know that. So in the morning, we'll kick each other in the teeth, pull each other's hair out, slap each other up, and the evening we'll be having a cup of tea together. And the next day we'll do the same thing again.
But you're actually quite right. I think that's why everyone loves you so much, is the fact that it is that. You are urgent. You are there. You get the emergency and you deliver. And that's where that is. But don't you get frustrated as well, or perhaps believe that government hangs back because they think that you're going to step in and it's okay. Gift of the givers. They've got this.
It's not that they hold back. I've discovered that problem, and I've told that to them quite directly. I said, your guys' problem is your systems. I don't have a problem with individual people in government. For example, I tell you, one day we'll fight with one minister, the next day nine deputy ministers will be with us in some project. It's that kind of relationship. Mm. Fight with some councillor, and the next day the mayor calls you. Then you fight with the MEC, and the senior calls you to have a tea with him. So it's that kind of arrangement. So I tell government, and they've agreed, I won't tell you which ministers have told me this, but frankly, ministers and premiers directly have told me, our biggest problem is our own system. I said, you guys take too long. The guy at the bottom got a sign, then the guy above, and the guy above, and the guy above. I said, urgency, emergency, you guys need to have a system where you don't need to do all that. You have to have a system. It's an emergency. We bypass all rules. There's no water in Rahima Musa, and there's no water in Helen Joseph. By the time you guys decide to do that, to fix that thing up, there's already floods, the dams are full.
Yeah.
How many people have come to hospital? I said, you need to change your system. There's something seriously wrong with your guys' system. And that's why they said, one premier told me, he mentioned it publicly, the Eastern Cape premier, Oscar Mabuyane. He said it in front of the media. He said, when you ask Oscar Mabuyane for a wheelchair, it takes him 3 months to arrange it. to go to the paperwork, all this again.
Yeah.
You ask gift of the givers and you get it in 10 minutes.
But that's true. You do. But, you know, just hearing you say that and looking at the Rahima Musa Hospital, also Helen Joseph, weren't you quite appalled because a basic thing like the provision of water, if you can get it right, why can't government get it right? Doesn't it make you angry?
Well, I don't get angry because I just know that how the system works, you know. And if I'm getting angry, I'm going to be angry almost every minute for the whole day, you know. So it doesn't not going to help. And the problem was, it's again the system. And the other problem is government employees are civil servants. They don't understand emergency. They're not disaster people. They know how to sit in office and push pens and write papers. They don't know what's going on in the ground. They can't understand that they'll be more focusing now. Did it meet requirements? Did we drill it properly? Did we register it in the correct manner? How did we get the water in the right way? My friend, the ICU has no water.
Mm.
The children are going to die. There's no operations can be done. It's an emergency. Oh, but did you get an element of... Now, that's the mentality you're dealing with.
Yeah.
They don't understand urgency and emergency. And there's a lack of proper skill, unfortunately. You know, and then, you know, and one day, and I was in a meeting with them, and the other thing I pushed was for the opening of Charlotte Mekeke. I said, how can you guys close for 2 months, but only one part is fixed? They said, no, they're waiting for a compliance certificate.
Yeah.
I said, compliance certificate, before the fire or after the fire? They said, no, it is after the fire. So I said, before the fire, the building that was not affected, no compliance certificate was required. Now suddenly there's a fire, there's a compliance certificate required. Has every hospital got compliance? They said, no. So I said, in my hospital.
Exactly.
I asked for a specific fire door. I said, is that fire door in every other hospital? They said, no. So I said, what's the problem? And 4 days later, of course, the premier opened it. And then I said, you've got to overrule everybody. This can't stay like that. It has to be opened because we're in COVID-19 and we're losing our 400 beds. In charge of the KK, because in the height of COVID, Charlotte has 400 COVID beds. What's wrong with you people? And then one of the doctors from Rahima Musa finally exploded in that chat.
Yeah.
She said, you know, the MEC didn't say much, the female was talking. And then he said, people in the health services must not say everything is fine. Nothing is fine. We are not right at the hospitals. We are battling. We are stressed. So don't go in the public and create the impression everything is fine. Nothing is fine.
No.
He's starting to find that people are talking out, but very, very good. You know, he sort of put his foot down and said, we need to fix the systems. And 4 days later, that hospital opened up.
Yeah, say it for what it is. Our guest, our profile interview today is Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman. Now, Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman is the head of Gift of the Givers. Taking some of your calls shortly, 011-883-0702. So many more questions I have for Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman, including hostage negotiations. There's that as well. Who qualifies for aid? But I'd like some of your questions as well. You can also leave a WhatsApp voice note message on 072-702-1702.
702.
Add your voice.
Have your say.
Let's walk the talk.
23 minutes to 9 o'clock, and our profile interview this morning on Weekend Breakfast is Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman, Head of Gift of the Givers. Doctor, thanks so much for holding through the break. Now, just a question here about hostage negotiations. You're not all about aid as well. I know that you got involved with Stephen McGowan. You were quite influential in getting his release. Take us through what happened there.
Well, the experience came before that. It was when Yolande Corky and Peter Corky were taken hostage in Yemen in 2013. It was a time that we were in Syria. And I had just opened up an office in Yemen before that. Actually, I went to Syria in October 2012. 2 months before that, I was in Yemen in August 2012. Opened an office there, and I brought the office there to Syria. I told him, you're a journalist. You speak Arabic. You understand the people's culture. I need you with me. So he came in April, and then when we got back, about a few weeks later, he calls me from Yemen, and he says, you know what? There's two South Africans have been taken hostage here inside Yemen. Do you know about it? So I told him, honest, I just saw it today in today's papers. Then he asked the question, asked me, is what do we do? Is hostage negotiation something that we do? You know? So at that point of time, I said, look, our motto says, best among people benefit are those who benefit mankind. I think it fits in this category. Let's just do it. And so we started off. We had no experience with hostage negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
But we said what we will do is we will increase our profile in the country because we were only there for a few months. And I said, let's increase our profile and start building more aid to more areas and get more people to know who we are. To use social responsibility as leverage, because we have no leverage. And we don't know who the people are. And that time, we don't even know who took them. Could it be some guy with a form of the company that they work in, some personal gripe, was it a terrorist group? We don't know. And so we started that process. And every year he went, he announced that I'm Anas Alhamati. I represent the South African group. They call Gift of the Givers. Two South African people have been taken hostage here by somebody in this country. And it's not the right thing. South Africa helps us. And from May, he made an announcement in every distribution throughout the country. And we increased the distribution multifold. On January 6th, 2014, he got a call. It was a Monday. And he said, are you the guy from this organization in South Africa that keeps announcing in the media that you want somebody to talk to you to say who's taken these people? So they said, yes, we've taken the person, the people. Tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock, be in Taiz, the place in Yemen, 10 o'clock in the morning, come alone. So he goes there.
Yeah.
And before he goes, we workshop what we're going to do. And we take all the pictures of helping the poor, the disabled, the physically challenged, you know, the blind people, everything, you know, the cleaning hospital, cleaning food, helping prisoners, whatever we did. That's the only thing we had to negotiate. So he gets to the door. The moment he comes in, you welcome, the welcome message, because we still don't know who it is. He said, do you know who we are? They said, do you know who we are? We are Al-Qaeda, and you know what we're capable of.
Sure.
And then,
wow.
And I, so to get to Stephen's message, the story started there. Now, because it was Al-Qaeda in Yemen, it was Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb also, in Mali. So we had a fairly good idea after the experience with Yolandi and Pierre how the mind works. So when Yolandi was released and we were working on Pierre's case, Stephen's father, Malcolm McGowan, came to me in February 2014. And he said, Dr. Silliman, I know you're very busy with Pierre's case, but can you help me get Stephen out? It's been 5 years. It was almost 5 years at that point. And, you know, and nobody could tell him, give him any information, what has happened to Stephen. He couldn't get any feedback from anybody. Can you help? So I told him, Malcolm, look, 4 to 4 years. I can't do anything now. The problem is I have no office in Mali. I don't know anybody there. I don't know what leverage to use. Unlike with Yolandi, you know, we had an office in Yemen, which helped. I can't promise anything, but I can't do anything now. Because one case alone takes these means nerve-wracking. I make one mistake, they shoot the hostage. You know, so I have to be really careful, and I can't have the burden of two hostages at the same time.
Mm.
So he said, I understand. I don't mind. In 6 December, Pierre passed on when he and Luke Summers were trying to be released. They were released. Pierre's release was secured by us. He was coming home that morning.
Oh, no.
The Americans went in, and Luke and some folks passed on. Then, in the same year, December, I told Malcolm, you know what, one of our office managers is going to see his son in Mauritania. The best we can do in Mauritania is next to Mali. Let's see if we can find some leads there. We failed. Couldn't find any leads. In June 2015, I saw the video with Stephen and Yuan Ostasin on the video. And I just put it on, and I phoned Malcolm. I said, Malcolm, the video is telling me they want to talk. They want to talk. I can tell you now from the way the video is presented, they want to talk. Mm-hmm. I'll take your case. And I made an announcement on your radio station. A guy heard the announcement on your radio station.
Right, yeah.
And I said, yeah. I said, I'm looking for a person of Mali origin who doesn't mind going to Mali to assist with hostage negotiation, who knows the government, the tribal leaders, the traditional people, who's not afraid, who's going to take a risk and to go all over the country. 2 hours later, a guy walks into the office in Johannesburg. He said, I heard your message.
Wow.
702.
Wow, the power of radio and the power of your organization working together, that's quite something.
Yeah, and then it's a long story. But eventually, what people couldn't do in 4 months, well, in 4 years, we traced Stephen in 6 weeks.
Yeah, and he came back. I mean, I spoke to him. We've actually become good friends, Stephen McGowan and I. And he came back and sort of thanks to you. I mean, that's quite something. Doctor, I want to take a quick call. Margaret in Bryanston. Hi, Margaret. Good morning.
Hello. I just wanted to say to Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman that I admire his work and his organization so much. It takes a lot to do what he's doing. He's an absolutely amazing leader, and my admiration knows no bounds. Please tell him.
You just told him yourself. Thank you, Margaret and Bryanston. You see, they agree you are Superman.
I do the best I can.
That's quite something. And just getting back to the hostage negotiations, it was what happened with Pierre Corky was very unfortunate, because the U.S. Navy SEALs went in, and like you said, he was killed in that. But you saw with Stephen that he came home, and he's now been reunited with his wife and his dad. His mom did unfortunately pass away. What happens in a situation like that, though, Doctor? When do you decide to take the case? Are you just open for business, or are there sort of prerequisites that go with that?
Look, it's a very expensive business. We don't take any money from anybody. We don't charge anybody. We don't get paid like consultants get paid, like $1 million, $2 million, $3 million. We don't take any money. It actually costs us money to assist, you know, in those areas with sending supplies. But Yolande, with Pierre's case and Stephen's case, it costs us close to $6 or $7 million.
Wow.
It supplies to the different areas. And we don't take any money from anybody. First of all, we know it's a terrible strain on the family who get people bluff them and say, I can help you, just give me £10,000. In the beginning, you get caught by every type of, you know, what you call it, guys, it's honest.
Yeah.
And the same kind of people. And you're desperate. You're not functioning in your business. You can't think clearly. You're not making money. Your livelihood is going down for this. So already you're so traumatized that your family member is caught up for so long and you don't know what the hell's going on. So, you know, we just find it hard to take money. And then the process itself is very, very long. It takes a long time because it's a huge responsibility, because you make one mistake, they're going to shoot hostage. And it's going to be on your end.
Oof.
And you're going to sit for hours discussing, and you have to be consistent with what you said. What you said 8 months ago must be the same thing that you say 8 months later. The story can't be changed. So you have to be careful and absolutely mindful of what you said. And as much as you say, look, I don't want to take this damn case anymore again, it's a headache, you know, it's nerve-wracking, it's time, it's consuming, it finishes you. It's easier to do a disaster in 7 days than for 100,000 people than to take out one guy with hostage.
Yes.
You know, it's very exhausting. But when you see a terrorist come to you, and you see, when you look at the face and you see the heartache, it's just like, I can't say no. I got calls now. In one state, we got calls to help Johan Gustaf from Sweden. We helped to get him out. Mm. Now we got calls to help a Colombian nun get out. I got calls to have an Indian guy got taken from Ghana. He got out. But, you know, we gave them the deeds. What we say is, the Al-Qaeda guys actually say that if you need help, go to Gift of the Givers. They know the procedure.
Yeah. Well, you guys do. You've got the connections as well, I suppose. You've done this before. Do you ever get involved and say, okay, I tell you what, we won't get into paying ransoms and that, but we can build a well for you. We can give you food. We can sort of throw sunshine your way so that you will actually release the hostage.
Well, we've done that, but not to them directly. We said we can't be to you, because that means we are paying you for keeping us there. And we said, first of all, from a religious method, and then we have dialogue about that. You know, it's not direct. If you talk to a third or fourth person, you don't talk to them directly, because you don't know who they are. So they know who you are, and you know who they are, but directly you don't know each other, you know, exactly. You know the Al-Qaeda, and they know the Gift of the Gifts. But who we are exactly each other, we don't know that. Because there's like lots of intermediaries between the whole process.
Sure.
And then you tell them from a religious point of view, you know what, religion doesn't allow you to take a hostage. And they make up some concocted message to say, no, it is allowed. You know, it's completely warped. The understanding is completely warped. So you can't get through to them on that basis. Then you tell them, okay, we will help your people, you know, your children, your wives, or something. Your ransom price is twice, $12 million. You know, this is not Europe or America. This is South Africa. $12 million multiplied by 14, like, you guys want $100 million away?
Yeah, you can't pay that.
They can't sell it. And in most cases, what we've achieved was to get a ransom down from $12 million to $1 or $2 million.
Wow.
And then they tell us, right,
yeah,
now you're out of the equation. You could involve the Mali government, your government. Beyond this, you can't go. What happens after this is none of your business. So you get involved with your government. You get involved with the Mali government. The Mali state security gets involved. They said they need somebody to come fetch the hostage once the deal is made. The deal may be money. It may be goods. It may be some kind of deal. It may be release of prisoners. All those things are not in your hands. You made the connection. You put us together. We've spoken together. You know the procedure. You've explained them the procedure. Now it's in their hands.
Yolande,
we got out for free. We didn't pay 1 cent. And Pierre, the cost is $100,000, but okay, not to Al-Qaeda. If we put pressure on the tribal chiefs, and we go, Anas said, look, and one of the Anas' chiefs said, look, it's an embarrassment to our country. First of all, from a religion point of view, we're not supposed to take hostages. Secondly, from a religion point of view, these South African people have given us so much support and they've helped our women and our children in our country. We can't do one thing to get one hostage out of all the power that we have in this country. So they went to Al-Qaeda. They said, we're not asking you. We're instructing you. Stephen Gown will be released.
Wow. And he was.
He was. And he said the cost is $100,000 because when you went earlier, the American drones shot and killed some of their members. So they said, now what happens to the families of these people who took the risk? We need to take care of them. We need money for that. But we're not asking money for those that already died. We are asking money as a guarantee for the ones that are going now on the 6th of December to take him out. If we don't take him out, you don't pay us 1 cent.
Yeah,
if we take him out, you guys are going to give us $100,000 as money for risk money for our families. So I asked Yolandi, she said yes. Because we don't pay any money. Our donor money is not for foster situations.
That is so interesting. Doctor, what I want to do, I'm going to take one or two calls. We've got a little, we're sort of running out of time at the moment. Trudy in Mossel Bay, hi.
Oh, Dr. Suleiman, you are a blessing to our nation, and I wish to nominate you for the Nobel Peace Prize. I was devastated when I heard that the president nominated the Cuban doctors for this prize in 2021. I've been so touched with your missions. With a family in Somalia, as a nutritionist, I wanted to sign up, but I had two school-going children. Your mission at Helen Joseph was absolutely amazing, as I worked there for many years, and I was so devastated to see how run down the facility had become. I was told by a matron that it's because of me, to quote her words, with my white apartheid skin, that the place is like this. I was stunned. When you work in medicine, people are people. And you don't see color. You don't see religion. You don't see race. God be with you.
Oh, Trudy, thank you for that. Trudy and Russell. And Trudy's right in what she says. You don't see color. You just see problems, and you can fix them.
Well, let me teach you the first line. You help people of all races, all religions, all colors, all classes, all cultures, of any geographical location and any political affiliation. But you have them unconditionally. You expect nothing in return, not even a thank you. And he went on further to say, expect to get something, a kick up your back in what you're going to be doing. Mm-hmm. If you don't get a kick up your back, regard it as a bonus.
I like that. Mimi in Benoni. Hi, Mimi. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you so much. Dr. Suleiman, good morning. Could you please tell us just a little bit about the spiritual aspect of your journey? Because I do believe that you have a spiritual calling. Could you tell us a little bit about the history of it and how it actually came about? Thank you so much for everything that you do.
I think you missed the beginning of the show. The first bit in being in Turkey where it has been a calling for you. It must have been something quite phenomenal to say, I don't understand Turkish. This guy is speaking to me. I understand exactly what he's saying. And here we are many, many, many years later.
And he talked about another thing every time I met him. He said, a lot of the things that I tell you now, you won't understand. He said, you'll understand them later. It'll make more sense later. You know, when you read the poems, you know, I couldn't understand English poems, I'll be honest with you. I treat everything as unseen in the exam. Never read them before, and I was not the guy that loves poems and all that kind of stuff. But in any case, when you read it, you know, the guy said there's five different meanings for the damn same thing. You can interpret it like this, that, and the other. And it's a similar kind of situation here. When he tells you something, you think, okay, it's this. 5 years later, say no. It looks like it was this. And another 5 years later, say no. But even this applies. So there's a level of changing from a spiritual point of view in the messaging that is given to you. And it's applicable in different situations, but the same words applies in different contexts in a different way.
Yeah. Let's take a voice note quickly.
Good day, Ray. I just want to say I've been following Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman, and what a great man. God must bless this man. He's doing such wonderful work. If we had more people like him, this would have been a much, much better place. Regards, Gav.
Thank you very much, Gav. Doctor, you are receiving a lot of fan mail this morning, and I think it's rightly so. In fact, there's an SMS here that says, we appreciate you so much. Words are not enough. Thank you very much for what you do. All the best, Lerato from La Rochelle. I think South Africans at the moment are just so desperate for service delivery, so desperate for help, and this has just come at the right time.
Well, it's there all the time. You know, as I told you, people wait, you know, they wait patiently, they wait anxiously, they wait for weeks, they wait for months. And a lot of people in government are not doing their job. And, you know, as a lot of people don't even know how to do their job. So and when we get requests for assistance, the problem is that the more successful we are, the more requests we get. That's the problem. And we can't get so many areas at the same time. And we don't do things fast. Whatever we do very professionally. And of course, what we do is cost a lot of money. So, you know, but we try our best to take a project, do it well, and benefit hundreds or even thousands of people at any one time. In 3 or 4 months, we drilled 420 boreholes, you know, in the country.
Wow.
And imagine how many thousands of people people drink water from those boreholes, washing, cleaning, drinking, medical support, all that kind of stuff. We went into Sunderland in 2018. Sunderland was collapsing. They had 440,000 sheep, sorry.
Mm.
And the sheep count is dropping rapidly because of the drought. It finally dropped to 32,000 in January this year. We put in 233 boreholes for free.
See, it's amazing. The stories the stories that you've told us this morning have been absolutely amazing. And we have to leave it there, I'm afraid. We are way out of time. I could carry on chatting to you for the next hour. But Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman, thank you so much for coming on to the program. I really do appreciate it. And we look forward to watching your next adventure with Gift of the Givers.
Thanks, Leah. Thanks to all the listeners and all the support and everyone that deserves support. And let's make South Africa a fantastic place. No racial issues, no tension, no friction. We are all one brotherhood. Let's work together for the common good of all of us, that we can achieve things for the interest of not us, at least our children and our grandchildren, so that one day when we leave, we know we made this country a harmonious place where we all work together and there's no color, no religion. There's only humanity as human beings working together.
Thank you so much. That's Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman and a Nobel Prize. There we go, Mr. President. I know you listen to 702. I think Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman should be on that list.